Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, August 20th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory, in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
So, Kevin, you may have driven past one this morning without even noticing it. A small camera quietly photographing passing cars. Flock Safety has built a network of more than 120,000 of these license plate readers across the country. There are other companies that are doing this as well. The cameras are in Philadelphia, they're in South Jersey, they're in Wilmington, Delaware. And police say they're powerful crime-fighting tools. But a Washington Post investigation found officers accused of using them to track and sometimes stalk their wives, girlfriends, and exes.
Very disturbing.
Yeah. In some cases, Kevin, police departments didn't even uncover the questionable searches. Journalists, activists, and victims did. And so this has raised a debate across the country. And so today we're bringing in some really smart people, including one of the Washington Post reporters who broke the Flock story. We'll talk about public safety, surveillance, and this growing debate over how these license plate readers are being used and possibly misused. And so, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Our question of the day: what's your take on police increasing reliance on surveillance cameras and these license plate readers? Do you think the cameras are keeping the community safe, or are they creating a mass surveillance system ripe for abuse? We'd love to get your take. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put your comments in the chat. And Kevin, I have to say, I knew they were there.
Right.
But I didn't really know or pay attention until now.
Yeah, it seems like one of these things where always technology outpaces oversight, right? The technology keeps advancing. People adopt it, and maybe they don't fully understand what could go wrong. And they implement these systems. And now we have an example of what it looks like when it goes wrong, and it could go much worse. So I'm curious to hear the conversation today and get the inside scoop. And I think it's going to be a great episode of Studio 2.
And you know what it is? Today is Thursday.
DJ of the day.
This could be a great opportunity for some songs.
Yeah,
okay. Related to surveillance.
Yeah, watching you, surveillance. Let's not do this. Let's not do the police song. But yeah, there's plenty of great options out there, and I'll pop out after the first segment, and I'll be the one picking the DJ of the day. So, you know, come at me with your good game.
Yeah, email studio2@whyy.org and get them into EP Kev by 12:30, and you could be our DJ of the day. And so we have a trio of local news stories, and Kevin, you're kicking us off.
Yeah, first story. We got word today that Philadelphia is on the short list
to be
the host city for the 2028 Democratic National Convention.
Yay.
Okay, DNC officials are considering us, Boston, and Denver, and now Atlanta and Chicago were considered in the running, but no more. Philadelphia, as you remember, hosted the 2016 DNC, where delegates nominated Hillary Clinton, and the bid this year included local Dems and city boosters hosting DNC chair Ken Martin for a three-day trip in the spring, where they wooed him and tried to boast of the city's readiness from the point of view of the arena in South Philly, transportation, security, and more. Local leaders say the city has gotten even better since 2016, become more of a national, international tourist destination, talked about some of the, you know, big events and marquee things that we've done in the decade since. And of course, we have a pretty great track record on that, including the World Cup this year. So we'll see what the DNC ultimately decides. The convention would be in the early August of 2028. GOP will hold its convention that year in Houston, Texas. Just from a pure media perspective, Cherry, like we're excited at the it's fun to be in the middle of it all.
OMG. And by the way, I was a reporter back in 2016 when we had the DNC, and it was so exciting to be on the floor. As history was being made, it was a huge boon to the city. And, of course, even though we hosted the DNC about a decade ago, it'll be 12 years in 2028. I do think we have a strong chance here compared to Boston and compared to Denver. I mean, you think about it. Pennsylvania is a purple state. The road to the White House comes through Pennsylvania. Philly is a blue city, so it makes sense.
I'm sure they're making that argument that just having the excitement of it being in Pennsylvania maybe gets Democrats more juiced up and gets turnout out. Maybe they're making that argument. Now, in 2016, of course, it did not work. Hillary Clinton got the nomination but did not win Pennsylvania.
Yeah, facts.
So those are the context.
Yeah. Second story on the list, Temple University for the very first time is requiring that most freshmen live on campus. That's going to be coming up in the next school year. The requirement will be for students under the age of 21. And of course, there will be exceptions for students living locally or dealing with hardship. But this is a pretty big deal for Temple, which for much of its history has been viewed and sold as a school for commuters. It's only in recent decades that Temple has transformed into this research institution and has had this on-campus living community. But Temple University President John Fry has said this new policy is an opportunity to shore up student success by being more intentional about the first year experience. According to university officials, only 63% of freshmen and 22% of all undergraduates lived on campus last fall. And I will say that this type of requirement is not unusual.
Right.
Many universities require freshmen live on campuses. In fact, Drexel and Penn, they both require students to live on campus their first 2 years. Dickinson over in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, they want students living on campus all 4 years. So this is not something that's unusual. But apparently, when you live on campus, you're more likely to finish college, right? You're more likely to be successful and do better in your classes because you're closer to support. It also helps with campus safety because a lot of the things that happen bad happen close to campus or off campus. And it also brings in revenue to the university and eases some of the demand on off-campus housing. So shout out to the Philadelphia Inquirer for this story. And Temple has released a strategic plan, which will include a 1,000-bed residence on Broad Street. So they're going to be expanding their housing options.
New leadership at Temple the past few years. John Fry, obviously has experience with Drexel, running Drexel before. So I'm sure part of this is him looking at what he felt worked there and what can work at Temple. And from the point of view of safety and kind of building school community, he's saying this makes sense for what Temple needs to do to grow. But yeah, it's interesting, right? The Temple Owls, they get their name from the idea that people came to night school there. They drove in and they were the night owls. Mm-hmm. So it's a new era for Temple.
Yeah, it's like a culture change. And by the way, I should mention that this has probably not a lot to do with enrollment because enrollment has been up. They welcomed a record-breaking 5,300 plus students last fall. So, you know, we'll see how it goes.
All right. Story number three, Cherry. There's a scam going around the literary and entertainment world. And unfortunately, it has a connection to WHYY's very own Terry Gross.
Not Terry.
No, not Terry. Get your name out of her, their mouth, as the saying goes. Scammers are reaching out to authors, thinkers, and entertainers via email, posing as Terry Gross, inquiring about a potential interview. And then if, someone responds to that request, the scammers request payment to be on the show. So this is a huge, huge no-no in Fresh Air land, in WHYY land, in journalism, serious journalism writ large. We don't pay for or solicit payment in exchange for interviews. And this is something internally that has been kicking around. We learned about this in recent days, but shout out to the Inquirer for digging deeper to find that there is a larger trend here where scammers are also catfishing using names like Katie Couric, Nikki Glaser, Amy Poehler. It's unclear if any of these scams are connected, but what we do seem to know is that what they have in common is using AI to try to mimic the style of a host like Terry Gross, and using AI to find details that they can flatter these like potential victims with, right? And it goes from people like Steven Pinker, who's like, you know, a big name author, to people like a somewhat random professor at UPenn or Drexel and say, hey, I saw your book. Oh, and I loved it. And here's all the great things I learned from it. Now I'm interested to have you on my show.
And I mean, I honestly, when I read this, I could see how people fall for it. I mean, because who wouldn't want to be interviewed by the one and only Terry Gross? It's huge. But I want to be clear, there is never money exchanged for these interviews. That's something we don't do at Studio 2. They don't do a Fresh Air. It's a huge red flag. I also should mention that Tanya Mosley has also been named in some of these scams. And it's really sad because there's this huge distrust in media generally. And then you throw this in there with a money component, people getting tricked and feeling some kind of way. That's not cool. But as Kevin said, keep Terry Gross's name out your mouth. We don't play about Terry.
No, no. And, you know, it does speak to just this fear that we've had for how people will use AI for ill purposes and scams. You know, they've already been a big problem. We had a whole show on the scam industry in recent years, and it's going to get worse as these models get better at doing stuff like
that. And by the way, I just wanted to mention, I want to change the subject really quickly because I want to make sure we get this in. We have a big event.
Oh, yes, yes. That's right,
a week from today.
Yeah, it's the Philly Bike Race. It's back.
It's back.
It's back, Cherry. Mm-hmm. And we're getting pumped. Our tires are getting pumped. Our hearts are getting full here.
Yes.
It's been more than a decade since the race was held. Next Thursday, ahead of race weekend, we're going to be in Manayunk at Love City Brewing to get the inside scoop on how this all came back together. We're going to get insights from the race organizers. That includes former Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter.
Ooh.
And you can be there with us at this special Studio 2 live broadcast event. But you need to register now at whyy.org/events. Please go there, register now, join us. It's going to be a fun Thursday. People who come are going to get a free beer in the process.
All of that. And by the way, don't go anywhere. In addition to registering for next week's event, we hope you stick around. We're going to be talking about those license plate reader cameras. Stick with us. This is Studio 2. We will be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. Flock cameras are currently scanning millions of car license plates all around the country. The solar-powered automated license plate readers store an image of your plate and search crime databases for local law enforcement agencies. But recent investigations have shown how easy it is for this data to be misused. And now there's growing public backlash. The Washington Post identified 69 law enforcement officials under investigation for unauthorized use of the data, including spying on current or former romantic partners. And now some departments, including in Wilmington and Abington, they are canceling their contracts with Flock over privacy and data security concerns. But many law enforcement officials say, not so fast. These are invaluable crime-fighting tools helping to track and catch criminals. So today, we're going to talk about questions raised by this technology around surveillance and modern policing. What's the right balance to make communities safe, but may also to maintain personal privacy? And I want to introduce our guest. We have Drew Harwell. He is one of the reporters behind the Washington Post investigation revealing that dozens of officers were misusing the Flock system. Drew, welcome to Studio 2, and thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And for our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, as always, we'd love to hear from you. What's your take on police increasing reliance on surveillance cameras and license plate readers? What are your concerns? Are they keeping folks safe, or are they creating a system of mass surveillance? You can give us a call at 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat. And so, Drew, I just wanted to sort of start by level setting and tell us a little bit about Flock. Before we go into your investigation, what is Flock Safety, and what exactly do they do, and how are they connected across the country?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Flock is the biggest, most prominent license plate reader company in America right now. Like you said earlier, most of your listeners have driven past these many times, probably even today, without even realizing what they had driven past. There are little boxes on the side of the road that take pictures of your license plate. They create a time-stamped recording of the fact that you drove past there. And police can later review a database of all of those data points to basically map where people drove. And so police have used these to investigate crimes, chase down bad guys. But we've also seen a lot of cases of abuse where bad cops have misused them to, spy on women in their life, exes, wives, former girlfriends, new partners. So it's a big problem. It's not a new technology, but it's technology that we're really having to deal with more often now because there's 130,000 of these across America.
Wow. And so let's go into your investigation. So what, first of all, sparked the investigation, and then tell us what it is you all found?
Yeah, so a couple months ago, we actually got a tip to look into an officer in Georgia who had been recently indicted for, again, using these cameras to spy on an ex. And the question in our mind was, how often is this happening, right? Mm-hmm. Is this just a one and done kind of thing? And what we found through reporting was that there are at least 70 of these cases across the country. And we even had a story yesterday in the Washington Post where we were able to find even new cases where the police departments didn't even know that abuse was happening. We could go into the data ourselves and find instances where cops were running hundreds or thousands of searches on people in their life without the agency stopping them or even knowing. And so these were pretty horrifying to the women. You know, we spent time with some of the women who were surveilled in these cases, and they were shocked to learn that they were stalked so precisely, right? And in a lot of these cases, you know, the surveillance was just one part of the control from these men. These men were sending them menacing messages, going outside of their house, just creeping them out in lots of different ways. So it was really kind of unnerving for these women because they were being stalked so closely, but also is by the police. A lot of them wondered, you know, who am I supposed to go to for help when I'm being, you know, assailed like this by somebody I'm supposed to trust?
Yeah, and one specific case, if we could zoom in for a moment, out of Georgia, you had the chief of police involved, sort of searching up his ex hundreds of times. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And why was it that no one in the department had any oversight over what this person was doing?
Yeah, it was a wild story. I mean, this was a woman named Marcy Bakley I spent some time with. She's a single mom, Air Force veteran, and she had dated the police chief of a small town in suburban Atlanta. They broke up, and the guy had just ran hundreds of searches on not just her, but the car from her teenage daughter as a form of control. No one was paying attention. He was the police chief of the department, so he basically ran the data of the agency, and no one was really looking there. You know, flock records, flock mm-hmm. searches are recorded into audit logs, but it really is up to the agency if they're going to actually review people's search histories. There's a couple states that mandate reviews of these audit logs, but a lot of them, it's just the Wild West. So this was a case where a cop was able to do this with no oversight. He was later arrested after Marcy basically called him in, and he actually later committed suicide before he even went to trial. But it was just a sad case because I spent time with Marcy, and she was just really horrified and scared by what she had gone through. And this is a case we see happen over and over again.
And so this is a bad actor. And it seems like there's dozens of people who have done this sort of all across the country. But just before we talk about how, you know, we broaden this, I want to get just a general understanding of what law enforcement typically uses this for. Because we talked about at the top of the show how people are driving down the street. These cameras take pictures all day long of so many cars that are on the street, but they're typically not used by bad actors. This is typically used for investigation, for law enforcement activities that are actually in the normal course of business.
Yeah, like a police officer, you know, the anecdotes we've gotten from Flock and the agencies we've talked to, the general course of using this would be if I'm looking for a stolen car or an arsonist or somebody who is in a location where I generally know where they were, or I'm trying to find the car of somebody who I'm trying to track, I can type in their plate into the database. I can get not just, you know, their recorded location data from my jurisdiction, but also all the jurisdictions that are sharing their data with me. So often these are places that are hundreds or thousands of miles away. And so, you know, Flock has shared some success stories where this has been used to stop kidnappers you know, really bad criminals. And, you know, some agencies have said this has been a groundbreaking tool for us because we can't have cameras on every block and that this gives us that level of precision. So it's really become kind of a question of what's the right balance in terms of positive crime fighting ability and this potential mm-hmm. negative that happens from all of the surveillance happening across the country.
Yeah. And what kind of oversight is involved with most police departments, or is there oversight?
It really depends on the department. You know, there's 18,000 police agencies in this country. You know, about maybe 40% of them use Flock. Some are very aggressive about oversight. A lot that we found are not aggressive at all. They are letting cops use Flock with no supervision. Nobody's checking their search logs. And, you know, state by state, there's no real federal law for these license plate reader regulations. State by state, the laws change. There's 13 states that require audits of cops' use of license plate reader technology. But that means, you know, there's many states where it's basically, again, the agencies get to decide their rules. So I think that's one big gap here is that the best practices for making sure these tools aren't abused are not followed. And there's just a lot of agencies that get to effectively police or not police themselves.
Yeah, I want to take a step back for a moment because I'm wondering, like I said at the very top of the show, it's like we know these cameras exist, but I think very few people knew how widespread the use was, that there were so many and that they're all across the country and really connected. How did we get to this place where this company was able to grow and this network of companies with cameras were able to grow and become so pervasive in our lives and most people not even really be paying attention to that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something I think about too. You know, again, license plate readers are not a new technology. They're basically just cameras on steroids. And I remember after January 6th in 2021, some of those people who had stormed the Capitol were caught basically by license plate reader data, finding that they had driven to DC. But Flock has really been the game changer here. They made it a household name. They're a tech company. They have a lot of Silicon Valley investment, and they went very aggressively, basically door to door in terms of city halls and police departments, advertising this as a technology and really making it user friendly and going to these, you know, often very small police agencies, neighborhood watch groups, homeowners associations, even strip malls, and saying this is a software package. We'll install the cameras. We'll run the software. You can just turn it on and go. So that really has led to an explosion of these things, you know, not just in the public consciousness, but just in America. And we have now seen both the good and the bad of that really flourish as well.
And the bad is these bad actors. And so I want to bring in another guest. There are plenty of people, including in law enforcement, that have argued that this is a technology that we need, that this is an essential tool for crime fighting and makes our towns and cities safer. So I want to bring in someone who makes that case. We have Rafael Mangual. He's an attorney and fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's a member of the Council on Criminal Justice. Rafael, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And so, you know, Drew has so aptly laid out the history of the growth of these cameras. He's talked about some of the bad actors, but also some of the positive uses of these types of cameras, these license plate readers. I want you to lay out your point of view on how law enforcement has been using them thus far.
Yeah, I mean, I think the description was apt. I mean, when we see these cameras used and tapped into, these networks are generally tapped into in cases surrounding car thefts. You know, one of the kind of most compelling recent cases that I saw was a woman whose car was stolen while her 2-year-old was in the back seat. And because the plate got a hit on a Flock camera, they were able to track that car down within a few minutes and secure the child safely before anything bad could happen. So, you know, basically it's car thefts, it's, you know, shootings. For example, there's a shooting at a location and a witness describes the car, you know, that the shooter fled in, right? Police can put that information into a system and hopefully come up with a hit somewhere in the vicinity, make a stop and potentially make an arrest and solve a crime. So I do think these are really valuable tools. And while I think it's totally fair game and important even, you know, to highlight the cases of misuse and abuse, I think it's important to maintain the perspective here that we're talking about a dozen or two of these kinds of cases. And that has to be weighed up against, you know, the thousands and thousands and thousands of cases in which these cameras have proven helpful. My colleague Charles Lehman at the Manhattan Institute recently launched a database that is tracking news stories in which Flock cameras have been helpful in solving crimes, and has already come up with nearly 1,700 different stories involving everything from homicides to car thefts and abductions. So, you know, it's an important conversation to have, but we have to balance these interests appropriately.
And so, Raphael, I want to challenge you a bit, because I want to lay out an objection, because police don't just photograph a suspect's vehicle, right? The system photographs everybody's vehicle. It creates a searchable database from that information. Why isn't that mass surveillance?
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, it's not really mass surveillance because these things are fixed at points, you know, throughout a jurisdiction. We don't have nearly the kind of coverage that would allow these cameras to be used, for example, to track a car from, you know, origin to destination. And this is actually really important. The Fifth Circuit, in a case called Porter, recently rejected a Fourth Amendment challenge to the use of ALPRs based on this very finding, right? What they found was that, you know, the police department in question still wasn't able to find the car that they were looking for right away, despite getting hits on cameras. And I think New York City is a good example of this. New York City has probably more ALPRs to deployed throughout the jurisdiction than maybe any other city in America. As far as I'm aware, I think the number is at about 1,700 if you include both the fixed ALPRs and the ones that are mounted on police vehicles. But the city has more than 80,000 street segments. And one street segment is still too big to be seen in its entirety by a single one of these ALPRs. So, you know, it's just impossible to track a vehicle for the entirety of a trip. It doesn't really tell you what's in the vehicle, who's in the vehicle. And I think the most important part for the legal question is going to be that these vehicles are being photographed on public streets where they don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think that's going to end up, you know, being the more compelling point for courts who consider this issue.
Stan on Facebook kind of agrees with what you just said. He says, I have no problem with it. There's no legal right to privacy in public spaces. But I have to say, I mean, does the fact that I'm driving on a public road mean government should be able to compile my movements, for example, over days or weeks without me suspecting anything? Because these cameras are growing. There's 120,000 of them across the country. 130,000, I think Drew said, was last count. There's likely to be more and more and more. And they're all connected, it seems, Raphael. And so at what, in your mind, at what point is there a line where it does cross into a form of mass surveillance? Because right now, you know, they may not be able to track movements, but there's more and more cameras coming online all the time.
Yeah, I mean, some of the courts that have considered this have left the door ajar to exactly that kind of analysis, right? So, you know, oftentimes the people who are challenging these things in court will try to analogize to other instances in which courts have found, you know, a Fourth Amendment violation for things like cell site location data or historical geographic location data. And so far, all of the appellate courts that have considered this issue have basically said that, no, what's captured by ALPRs is just too different, right? Cell site location data can be used to track the phone wherever it goes, both in public and in private, over a long period of time. You can, you know, sort of see the address that it's at and figure out what businesses are there, what services are being consumed there. It paints a much more intimate picture of life. But they have said that, look, there might be a point in the future where, you know, streets are completely saturated with these things to the point where they can tell you the exact same thing that cell site location information could tell you, for example. And I think at that point, yeah, you'd start to run up against some serious privacy interests that might actually implicate the Fourth Amendment, in which case you'll start to see warrant requirements applied. But I do think it's important to note, too, not all of these cases are always going to have legitimate privacy interests. For example, a stolen car, right? The individual who's occupying the car that he doesn't own cannot assert a privacy interest in that piece of property that he's illegally occupying, right? So that's one kind of case in which, you know, the even if
and
there
we're
were
thinking
a
more, Raphael, we're thinking more of innocent folks, because folks, I mean, I think there can be some agreement, you know, that this has been helpful in law enforcement, but you also have innocent actors who have their privacy, have been having their privacy being violated here. By the way, I want to put out the question of the day again. What's your take on police increasing reliance on surveillance cameras and license plate readers? Is it good for public safety, or are we creating a system of mass surveillance? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can comment in the live chat. Aaliyah on Facebook says they are dangerous, along with law enforcement officers who use it to further abuse their authority. My family is on a road trip right now, and I'm terrified because too many times the cameras read license plates incorrectly as a stolen car plate. Of course, that gives the officers the okay to be super aggressive when pulling the driver over, placing them in cuffs, just to find out that the camera read it wrong. It's traumatizing. And I'd like to get both of your thoughts on that. We're using artificial intelligence with these cameras. We all know artificial intelligence can get it wrong, right? And you could literally have people's life on the line, as Aaliyah mentioned in that post. Your response to that, and Drew, I want to get your take on that. And then I'd love, Raphael, for you to respond as well.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's a real issue. And, you know, the AI gets better. But as anybody who has talked to Alexa or ChatGPT knows, like you said, it's not just wrong, but it's confidently wrong. And so we've seen multiple cases where the camera has seen an O where it should be a zero, or one where it should be an I. And cops have responded, you know, sometimes at gunpoint, pulling people out of cars, you know, accusing them of crimes they didn't do. So I think that is a real problem. And, you know, maybe it's a problem that has only happened to a couple people, and we need to hold it in perspective to the many good cases. But if you're that person at gunpoint, it's very real to you. And so, you know, I think that that gets to the bigger issue, which is just that we've only seen we've maybe seen 70, you know, six dozen or so cases of misuse, but that's just all we know about, right? There are many of these cases that aren't being detected because we don't have a lot of visibility, and we afford cops a lot of trust and operational secrecy to do their jobs. So I think there's a lot still about the accuracy and the safety of these systems that we don't know about that would be good to know to really evaluate them in full.
Yeah, and Raphael, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, as well as some of the self-governance that some of these companies, I mean, Flock just put in some safeguards recently, but this has been a growing issue, and I wonder, should we be relying on them to govern themselves? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple issues here. I mean, I would say that, you know, while I understand the fears that were articulated by the user on Facebook, I would say that those fears have been articulated for quite some time surrounding ALPRs. I mean, you know, as Drew noted, ALPRs are not new pieces of technology. I mean, I'm looking right now at an old headline that was published in 2012 by Ars Technica warning that our cars were being tracked and that largely unregulated cameras were collecting millions of travel records every day. And that piece was published in August of 2012, which is 14 years ago. And so I do think that, you know, some of the people who are seeing a lot of the hysteria surrounding this are sort of taking it as a cry of wolf because these arguments have been made for such a long time. And I would just point out that, yes, I mean, there are going to be these cases of, you know, a license plate being misread by one of these cameras. And that can result in a very traumatizing experience if you're pulled over at, you know, in a felony stop and held at gunpoint and put in handcuffs. I get all that. But we have to understand that that can happen without this technology, right? I mean, if police receive a report of a stolen car and someone, you know, a witness gives them the wrong plate and they see that plate on the street, they can pull that car over, you know, under the same circumstances, and the result is the same. I think that this probably, in the aggregate, increases the level of accuracy that police departments are working with. In terms of the, you know, self-auditing thing, I do think it's encouraging that we are seeing these cases of misuse and abuse come to light, and that we're universally seeing them punished and denounced by the very departments that we're, you know, told to fear in these cases. I do think that's a good sign. I also think it's important to keep this in perspective. Again, it's not ALPRs that make this sort of abuse possible. I mean, in 2016, there was a big piece, investigative piece published by the Associated Press about the degree to which police officers around the country were abusing their access to criminal history data bases and DMV
records. So you're saying this is not the only type of technology that we've seen law enforcement abuse. Let me bring in a caller before we go to the break. We have Liam from Philly on the line. Liam, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I guess my comment here is this technology worth, like, the infringement of the rights of everyone, even for the use cases where it is helpful? Like, I understand the argument that, you know, you don't have an expectation of privacy in a public place, right? People can take your picture. But really the problem here, the new technology, is a technology that can then track that. It's the system that can take that information, those pictures, put them together, and basically keep tabs on people that are just living their daily lives. That is my question or comment is, should should a system like that exist in a country or any place that wants to call itself free?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Liam from Philly. And I think Liam is sort of teeing up the second part of our conversation that's going to happen on the other side of the break. And so, Raphael, before we go to break, I want to give you like 30 seconds to sort of respond to that as we tee up the privacy part of our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just say that, you know, I don't think the characterization is entirely fair. I understand the worry about this technology being used to track someone's movements. But the truth is that there are so many holes in terms of the space between these cameras. They are a helpful tool, but they're nowhere near as effective as the other surveillance tools that police departments often rely on. And I think that we're a long way away from ALPR networks getting to the point of integration and saturation where that becomes a real risk.
Thank you very much. That voice was Raphael Mengual. He's an attorney and fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a member of the Council on Criminal Justice. Raphael, thank you so much for being on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Drew Harwell of The Washington Post is going to stick with us, right, Drew? And on the other side of this break, we'll hear from a privacy expert who is sounding the alarm about growing surveillance infrastructure. We'll also tackle what Leanne posed as a question. Is this type of surveillance positive in a free society? We'll talk about that on the other side of this break. This is Studio 2. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. We've been talking about the debate around automated license plate readers, which are being used by law enforcement. And one of the biggest companies is Flock. And there's been growing backlash against this technology as recent investigations have revealed that some of the data is being misused by police. It's raising a lot of privacy concerns. And Drew Harwell, a Washington Post technology reporter who was part of an investigation that brought this issue to public light, is with us. Drew, thank you for still being here with us today. I'd also like to reiterate our big questions of today. What's your take on police increasing reliance on surveillance cameras and license plate readers? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can comment in the live chat. I'm going to bring in another caller. We have Peter from Bensalem on the line. Peter, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, my question is that we're on a slippery slope. If this is combined with AI and ring cameras and cell phone observation, that it could all be linked together and track people.
Yeah.
Particularly journalists.
Yeah, that's a lot of fear. People have a lot of fear. Thank you so much, Peter from Bensalem, for your comments. And so, Drew, before we bring in our next guest, I just wanted to sort of talk about what Flock has done in recent days, weeks, in light of some of these cases of misuse by police and law enforcement coming out. What have they done to sort of help, you know, deal with some of the fears that have come as a result?
Yeah, they announced a couple of changes that I thought were pretty interesting. One, they said they would trim the default data retention time for agencies from 30 days to 7 days. So what that means is when it takes a picture of your license plate, the typical police department that doesn't change their settings will only have it for a week, though, of course, departments can change it to as long as a year. They've also changed it to where they are requiring, starting next year when they're turning on these changes, for police officers who are searching for plates to put in a criminal case number. You have to make one of those every time you open a criminal investigation. They were not requiring that before, which was pretty wild because we could see from the public records that cops were running these searches and not justifying them at all. So a lot of these cases where they were using it as basically a personal spy device for their ex-girlfriend, they weren't justifying it. So that made it very hard for internal affairs to examine whether they were legit or not. They made some other changes. You know, what I find interesting is they're only doing this now. Again, this is a 9-year-old company. These were, I would think, kind of low-hanging fruit, really. Mm-hmm. These were kind of basic oversight things. These were actually things we had brought up in our story that were, you know, that privacy advocates have discussed as, you know, these are things you could do to address abuse. I think it's good that they're rolling them out now, but I also kind of wonder what took them so long.
Yeah, John on Facebook says, just because a tool is useful for the police doesn't mean we should have to sacrifice our liberty and privacy for it. Benjamin Franklin once said, according to John, they who can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And with that, I want to bring in Matthew Guariglia, a senior policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He has a lot of concerns with the surveillance technology. Matthew, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, yes, thank you to be on.
So you've heard some of the talk that has been happening. You've heard some of the concerns of our listeners. You also heard Drew talk about some of the low-hanging fruit safeguards that Flock recently put in place. I'd like you to lay out your thoughts and your argument about these cameras, these you know, license plate readers that have sort of cropped up all across the country.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say. I mean, first is I think a lot of these reforms are much too little too late. People have been warning for years that the system they had created was, despite what some of your last guests have said, it is mass surveillance. It is warrantless mass surveillance writ large across the country, and they're collecting, you know, millions and millions of plates without a warrant, and police can search through these really without even, until this point, a criminal case number, let alone a warrant, which is what they should be getting. And it has definitely facilitated this type of abuse that a lot of people were warned were going to happen. Mm-hmm. And now that the harm has already been done, now that they have already marketed this and eaten up a lot of the market share for license plate readers, now they're deciding, oh, you know what? You guys were right all along. This technology is very dangerous. But it's easy to say now that they are a company that is valued at over $8 billion.
Yeah. And I wonder, though, you know, Matt, you know, you think about it, there's been hundreds of thousands of crimes that have been helped because of this technology. And we heard Raphael talk about, you know, stolen cars, a kidnapped 11-year-old being found because of Flock technology. There are a lot of positive uses for this. There's some privacy that may be given up, but there are positive uses. How do you push back against that?
Well, first of all, I would say that none of those cases would be hindered by a warrant requirement. If you are investigating a legitimate crime, you go to a judge, you talk about why you need to dip into millions of license plates to search for a specific car, you present your evidence, and sometimes they can turn around those warrants pretty quick.
Got to go find a judge. I mean, time is of essence, especially in kidnapping cases.
And I think that a lot of these companies have kind of ironed that out. They know how to get warrants mm-hmm. quickly. There are judges often on call 24 hours a day for exactly this purpose. But the other thing I want people to realize is that these are technologies, this is infrastructure that doesn't turn on when you're investigating a murder or a robbery, that these are on all the time. And just because a murder has not happened yet or there's no active shooting doesn't mean that they've stopped collecting plates. They're collecting plates all the time. And yeah, it would help law enforcement a lot if we all wore GoPros on our forehead all the time that were live streamable by police. But that's just not the system that we've created. That's not the system of laws that we have. And what this widespread dispersed surveillance network has done is it has totally inverted how the legal system is supposed to work, which is based on individualized suspicion.
Yeah. Let's bring in another caller. We have Ellie from New Jersey on the line. Ellie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, I wanted to ask about facial recognition software that we already use in places like cruise ports to allow people to pass through security checks more rapidly. Implementing that sort of technology as well as other biometrics, height, weight, you know, what the person's wearing, skin color, and including those in the Flock camera will capture so many more false positives, but also create more problems.
Yeah. And thank you, Ellie. And I guess the question is, is biometric data being wrapped in with Flock cameras at this point? I guess, Drew, Matt, I'm not sure who can answer that. Is that a reality that we're dealing with, or is that something that could become reality pretty soon?
I will say right now that is not something they're doing necessarily, but these are cameras. It's a software update to make that happen. Right now, they look for plates, but they're also starting to look for characteristics of a car. If I'm an officer and I want to find a white van with bumper stickers, mm-hmm. I can type those attributes in. So you see the the creep of what they're allowing for expanding it. And, you know, I think it's a good question to raise because you can connect these tools to make an even more precise environment. And one of the callers previously talked about Ring and Flock and doorbell cameras. It's really not hard to imagine in a couple years, as more of these cameras roll out, them all connecting and creating that patchwork. So that's where I start to kind of question the idea that it's not mass surveillance. It's not just that there's one officer on a street seeing you pass by. It's that there's a bunch of them taking notes on everywhere you go. And you know, Flock says itself, they do 20 billion plate scans a month. There's 300 million people in this country. So you have to imagine there are a lot of scans of every person. And we're in America. We drive everywhere, right? You can tell a lot from a person's life based on these little data points. So I think it's not hard to imagine that happening sometime in the future.
And so, Matt, I just wonder where the law stands right now, because at the very top of the show, we talked about how we always get this technology creep, and then there is legislation that fails to keep up with the technology creep, right? We get this. And so now we're at a place where maybe in 2012, you know, it was just a few cameras. Now there's, you know, well over 100,000 of these cameras all across the country, and legislation, where does it stand? Is it just non-existent? And could they even keep up given the pervasiveness of these cameras at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have been really failed, especially at the federal level, by our lawmakers who are, you know, supposed to be protecting our privacy. And they have not, either when it comes to government surveillance or when it comes to consumer surveillance by tech companies who are collecting that for purposes of advertising or the sale of data or what have you. And so I think where we see a lot of the action happening is at the local and state level. Mm-hmm. And the way people are reacting now, especially to the kind of panic around Flock, is by canceling those Flock contracts, which has been happening across the country. But we've seen that even before this current moment in the movement to, for instance, ban police use of face recognition or ban police use of, you know, AI predictive policing models, which has also happened across the country in the years preceding that.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have Susan from Bensalem on the line. Susan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, it's a comment. I was involved with on my way to work one morning several months ago. A school bus stopped at an intersection where there was a red light. I slowed down. I saw the school bus. She was disengaging her lights and closing her door, and that little stop panel that comes out was moving back into the bus. Once she did that, I pulled past her. A week and a half later, I got a $300 ticket in the mail and a piece of film that showed what they said was evidence that I had passed an active school bus boarding. And it wasn't the same school bus in the film. I think that the film was tampered with. Mm-hmm. I don't know who this third-party company was, but I couldn't get the police to sit with me and talk with me about it. No one returned my calls. And I finally just paid the ticket because of course, my insurance went up. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what happened there, but I don't like it.
Yeah. That's Susan from Bensalem. And by the way, Matt, a lot of people don't like the license plate readers that are all along Broad Street here in Philadelphia, where people are getting these tickets and speed cameras on Roosevelt Boulevard. People are just sort of not liking these cameras. And so just your thoughts on that and just this failure of our legislature to take any type of action. And in places that you have seen action taken, what does that look like?
You know, I mean, I think this is something to be concerned about, is mission creep, right? Is when mm-hmm. police put up these cameras, they justify it by saying they're going to look for, you know, shooters and robbers and all these like very serious crimes. But at the end of the day, you know, in most places, those kinds of crimes are actually kind of rare, and it doesn't stop these devices from being turned on and working. And it doesn't mean that enforcement stops. So we've seen license plate readers, these massive networks, being used to do background checks or to verify that somebody is sending their child to school in the district where they live by tracking their car. And so I think we're seeing that these cameras are becoming very, very useful to police for like everyday low level enforcement, which is not necessarily what you hear them talk about when they talk about why they need these cameras. And so what people have been doing is they've been putting pressure on police departments, on their city councils, on the people who are in charge with actually spending the public money to cancel these contracts.
And then we're seeing that happening here in Wilmington, Delaware, and in Abington, Pennsylvania. And so, Drew, last question before we wrap up. Just, you know, what do you see as the next steps? Because there's been a real crackdown on police who misuse this technology. But do you see things going further as more and more of these cases come to light?
Yeah, that's my question. We are seeing a lot of local resistance. I will say, you know, the number of canceled contracts is still very small compared to the number of contracts that are rolled out. There's 7,000 agencies that now work with Flock. So I'm curious now, as there's more public understanding of how these systems work and the potential failure points, whether that will continue. And I'm also curious how much the cops themselves are going to police their own shops. You know, and none of this is an indictment of all cops, right? That some of these bad cops were found by good cops who realized the systems were being misused. But I also want to understand, why are we as a country okay with these departments policing themselves, letting bad actors go, letting these women be spied on, you know, for doing nothing wrong? So I'm curious about that.
And thank you. That's the voice of Drew Harwell, Washington Post technology reporter, who is part of an investigation that brought this issue to public light. Thanks so much for being here, Drew.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to Matthew Guariglia, a senior policy analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks so much for being here, Matthew.
Thank you.
And by the way, today is DJ of the day. So now it's time to reveal our DJ. I'll hit it. Friday. That is Private Eyes, as covered by The Bird and the Bee from their 2010 album Interpreting the Masters Volume 1, a tribute to Daryl Hall and John Oates. And I got to say thank you to Peter Kay and John P for choosing that song and being our DJs of the day. Also have to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Al Banks and Mike Schiffler engineered today's show. Our executive producer and DJ of the day picker is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for everybody who called in, wrote in, and to you for joining us.